Good afternoon, brethren. The festival season is rapidly approaching, the fall festival season. And the seven-day fall festival is called the Feast of Ingathering in Exodus. And it's called the Feast of Tabernacles in Leviticus and Deuteronomy. I've always considered the two names interchangeable. But there's a sermon posted on the UCG website by Mr. Stanley Kitt, and he offers an explanation for why the festival was called by different names. His sermon is titled, Feast of Ingathering or Tabernacles, Which? And it's dated October 2nd, 2015. He presents the message logically and uses biblical evidence to support why the name changed. And I'm going to look at his premise and explain why the seven-day fall festival was first called the Feast of Ingathering, and then it was later called the Feast of Tabernacles. And I'll draw a lesson from the experience in Israel's history that caused the change. So we can begin in Exodus 23. Here in Exodus 23, God gave instructions for the holy days at Mount Sinai. Beginning in verse 14 through 16. Three times you shall keep a feast to me in the year. You shall keep the feast of unleavened bread. You shall eat unleavened bread 7 days, as I commanded you, at the time appointed in the month of Abib. For in it you came out of Egypt. None shall appear before me empty. And the feast of harvest, the first fruits of your labors which you have sown in the field. And the Feast of Ingathering at the end of the year, when you have gathered in the fruit of your labors from the field. So here it's called the Feast of Ingathering. This is the original name given by God. And it came during the time of the harvest in Israel, in the land that Israel was going to occupy. So even though they hadn't been there, God knew the growing seasons and that they would encounter there. They had just come out of Egypt, and the growing season in Egypt was different. The harvest time was different because it was based on the flood season of the Nile. So God told them the time of the year that this feast would occur. Let's see another mention Let's look at another mention of this festival in Leviticus, Leviticus 23. So this is another place where the holy days are mentioned, Leviticus 23. And in verse 34. Well, it starts 33. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, saying, The 15th day of this 7th month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days to the Lord. And then he describes more detail about it. So here he calls it the Feast of Tabernacles. And he tells us that it occurred in the 7th month. And let's look just farther ahead in verse 42 of chapter 23. So this is verse 42. You shall dwell in booths for 7 days. All who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And here, this fall festival period of time, they're told that they're going to dwell in booths. The same word that's used for booths is the same word used for tabernacles. And so the Hebrew word is sukkah, and it's the word is the same for both, tabernacles and booths. Let's look at another mention of the fall festival in Deuteronomy 16. And in verse 13, so this is Deuteronomy 16, 13. You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days, when you have gathered from your threshing floor and from your winepress. And here it's called the Feast of Tabernacles again. So the fall festival was called the Feast of Ingathering at Mount Sinai. And then, after 40 years in the wilderness, it was called the Feast of Tabernacles. So Leviticus and Deuteronomy must have been written after they've had this 40-year experience. And in Deuteronomy here, it mentions that this was also a time period where Israel gathered their produce at the end of the growing season. And so this feast is associated with gathering a harvest. In fact, if you look at verses 15 and 16, so this is Deuteronomy 16, verses 15 and 16. 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses, because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you surely rejoice. And so it mentions produce here, which is the product of a harvest. So why did the name change from ingathering to tabernacles? For one thing, it pointed backwards to when the Israelites dwelt 40 years in booths. God commanded them to keep the feast to remind them that they lived 40 years in the wilderness. He wasn't reminding them of some great or important thing that they did. He just wanted them and future generations to know the great mistakes they made so they wouldn't repeat them. If Israel had obeyed God, they wouldn't have had to spend the 40 years in the wilderness. And you could look at it this way. God revealed his original intent for Israel by calling the fall festival the Feast of Ingathering back in Exodus 23:16. There, at that time, there had been no physical event upon which to name the festival Feast of Tabernacles. They hadn't spent 40 years in the wilderness yet. God entered a covenant of marriage with Israel. Let's look at Ezekiel 16 and see what he said there. Ezekiel 16, verse 8. This is verse 8. When I passed by you again and looked upon you, indeed your time was the time of love. So I spread my wing over you and covered your nakedness. Yes, I swore an oath to you and entered into a covenant with you, and you became mine, says the Lord God. So he's talking to Israel here. He wanted Israel to be a model nation to all nations. And he said he would establish an everlasting covenant with Israel. He said it would be everlasting in verse 60. Let's look in the same chapter, 16, verse 60. Nevertheless, I will remember my covenant with you in the days of your youth, and I will establish an everlasting covenant with you. So God intended Israel to be the type that foreshadowed the end time harvests. That's why he called it a Feast of Ingathering, a time. And as we know now, the feast represented a time when Jesus Christ will gather his people from all corners of the earth. And it represents the first fruits harvest, those that are called and converted during the New Testament church era. And the second resurrection harvest, when all people will have an opportunity to enter God's kingdom. So the end time harvests will be the anti-type that will fulfill the type foreshadowed by the Feast of Ingathering. This is the academic scholarly language that you'll read if you read it. Explanations or discussions of this subject. So for my benefit, I had to define these terms, antitype, type, and foreshadow. So an antitype is a person or thing represented or foreshadowed by a type or a symbol. So it would come after something that comes before it that would represent the antitype. And the type is the thing that comes before it. So you could say that the type foreshadows its antitype. And to foreshadow means to represent or typify beforehand. So an easy example to visualize and think about would be Aaron was the type of the high priest and Jesus Christ the antitype of the high priest. So Aaron was the human physical example of a high priest, Jesus Christ the spiritual antitype. So Aaron foreshadowed Jesus Christ as the high priest. Israel stayed at Mount Sinai about 1 year. Then they left for the promised land. Let's look at a discussion of that in Numbers 10. Numbers 10, starting in verse 11. And reading 11 through 13. Now it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month in the second year that the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle of the testimony. And the children of Israel set out from the wilderness of Sinai on their journeys when the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. This was about halfway between Sinai and Jericho. So they started out for the first time according to the command of the Lord by the hand of Moses. This would have been about 35 days after Pentecost, and it was still about 4 months until the fall festivals would begin. So if you calculate the distance and rate of travel, they could have reached the wilderness of Paran, as one commentary said, in about 11 days. And they could have reached Jericho within 20 days, calculating, for example, Jericho is about 246 miles, traveling 12 to 14 miles a day, which some commentaries estimate they could have done, comes to less than 20 days. So God intended that Israel would invade and occupy Canaan immediately after leaving Mount Sinai. Let's look at descriptions of this in Deuteronomy, beginning in Deuteronomy 1. Deuteronomy 1, verses 7 and 8. Here, Moses reviews the Israel's journey from Mount Sinai. And verse 7, turn and take your journey and go to the mountains of the Amorites, to all the neighboring places in the plain, in the mountains and in the lowland, in the south and on the seacoast, to the land of the Canaanites and to Lebanon, as far as the river Euphrates. See, I have set the land before you. Go in and possess the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give to them and their descendants after them. And so this is immediately after leaving Mount Sinai. He told them to go in and take the land. And he intended that the Israelites conquer the inhabitants of the land. Let's look at that in Leviticus 18. Leviticus 18, again, is a description. It starts out, the verses 6 through 23 is where God warned the Israelites not to commit the sins that other nations had been committing, that the nations that they were to displace. So in verses 6 to 23, he discusses that. Then, after that, he pronounced the punishment for those nations. So, beginning in verse 24 of Leviticus 18, Do not defile yourselves with any of these things, for by all these the nations are defiled, which I am casting out before you. For the land is defiled, therefore I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out its inhabitants." So God intended the Israelites take possession of the land by force, as they began to do under Moses. As they approached the promised land, they did conquer some cities or nations, small nations, and they eventually did conquer most of the nations under Joshua and David. That was God's intention. So let's go back to Numbers 13 now. As Israel approached the promised land for the first time under Moses, Numbers 13. And verses 1 and 2. "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers you shall send a man, every one a leader among them.'" And so Moses sent spies, reconnaissance, to inspect the new land. And then there's a description of that in verses 3 through 24. Then in verse 25 through 29, they returned and they gave a very factual report to Moses and the people. It's not tainted with any bias of any kind. They just report what they saw. Well, starting in verse 30, Caleb gave a good report. I was looking to see, was there any negativity in verses 25 to 29? I don't see any right now. So anyway, Caleb just gave a good report. "Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, 'Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it.'" I think Caleb was just offering his opinion factually again. But in verses 31 through 33, "The men who had gone up with him said, 'We are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we.' And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, 'The land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak, come from the giants. And we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so we were in their sight.'" And so the other spies had came back with a negative report, a report of fear and doubt. And going ahead to verse 14, or chapter 14, verses 1 through 10 describe the spy, these negative spies, inciting the other people to rebel. And in verses 6 through 9, Joshua and Caleb tried to dissuade them. We could read that. Verse 6, "But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the land of Israel, saying, 'The land we pass through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." Verse 10, the people wouldn't listen. They wanted to hear none of that. And in verses 11 and 12, in fact, in verse 10, they wanted to stone Joshua and Caleb. They wanted to destroy them. In return, verses 11 and 12, God wanted to destroy the people for having that attitude. Then the Lord said to Moses, how long will these people reject me, and how long will they not believe me with all the signs which I have performed among them? I will strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them, and I will make of you a nation greater and mightier than they. In verses 13 through 19, Moses pleaded with God to spare the Israelites. He wanted God to have mercy on them. And so in verse 20, God pardoned the people. Then the Lord said, I have pardoned according to your word. Moses did persuade God to have mercy. But they still had to pay. So God didn't kill him on the spot. He allowed them to live 40 more years in the wilderness. Then they died. So in verse 21, there's a verse that kind of doesn't fit the mood or the subject of this discussion. It says, but truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. I perceive as being a prophecy. It's a prophecy of God's end game, of his plan. So here he reveals that his plan for his kingdom is that it will reign on earth when all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. One commentary says this statement could be part of God's oath to carry out Israel's punishment, which it does sit in the middle of. So God is talking about his plan to destroy the people. Israel's punishment. It could be taken that way, but you've got to stretch it a long way, I think. To me, it's a prophecy that God had his plan for his kingdom to be established toward the end of his plan. That kind of brings up the question, in my mind, did God already plan that Israel would be denied entry into the promised land? And that doesn't seem as likely. Well, when God made the decision, I think he planned it from the very beginning. Or did he change his plan after they angered him? So it's just the fact that this sits in the middle of the discussion that might make it seem like there's different interpretations. At any way, we understand God's kingdom will be established after Christ's return. So in chapter 14, verses 22 through 38, God initiated the beginning of Israel's 40-year journey in the wilderness. So Israel failed to enter the promised land under Moses. They lacked faith and trust in God to fight their battles. They refused to enter Canaan when God first led them there with Moses. Their rebellion and disobedience prevented them. They could have begun to carry out God's judgment on the nations. And Bible chronology does allow that Israel could have entered Canaan on the Feast of Trumpets under Moses' leadership. As I pointed out, just physically they could have walked there, reached there by the time of the fall holy days. So they didn't fulfill the meaning of the Feast of Trumpets in type. Trumpets, as we understand now, is a time when Christ returns, and one of his first tasks is to subdue the nations. And so that would be the antitype of Israel going into the promised land and subduing the nations there. And so the very first task that they had under Moses, they failed. Let's turn to Joshua 23. So under Joshua, they actually did go into the promised land. So Joshua 23. Beginning in verse 6, and we'll go from 6 through 9. And Joshua is talking to the people. Therefore, be very courageous to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, lest you turn aside from it to the right hand or to the left, and lest you go among these nations, these who remain among you. You shall not make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause anyone to swear by them. You shall not serve them, nor bow down to them, but you shall hold fast to the Lord your God, as you have done to this day. For the Lord has driven out from before you great and strong nations, but as for you, no one has been able to stand against you to this day. So Joshua is still displaying the faith and courage that he had when he was a spy. If you look at verse 7, there's one phrase in verse 7 that indicates that they didn't expel all the nations under Joshua. It says, unless you go among these nations, these who remain among you. So there's still some nations that needed to be expelled. David would more fully complete that also. Israel would have inherited and begun inhabiting the promised land under God's direction. Again, this is under Moses. They would have entered a physical rest. They could have lived peaceful, prosperous lives with God as their king. And the land would have produced crops abundantly. The festival would have been called the Feast of Ingathering. And God did eventually give Israel rest under Joshua. Let's look, we're still in the book of Joshua, just back a little, verse chapter 21, Joshua 21, 43 through 45. So the Lord gave to Israel all the land of which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they took possession of it and dwelt in it. The Lord gave them rest all around, according to all that he had sworn to their fathers. And not a man of all their enemies stood against them. The Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. Not a word failed of any good thing which the Lord had spoken to the house of Israel. All came to pass. So this occurred in type, to be filled in antitype, when the earth will enjoy the time of millennial rest in God's kingdom. And we learned earlier in Leviticus and Deuteronomy that the feast was called the Feast of Tabernacles to remind the Israelites and future generations of all of God's miraculous interventions and works during the 40 years in the wilderness. And as we understand now, it's the Feast of Tabernacles to remind those called and chosen in the New Testament era that our physical lives on earth are just temporary. So there's a lesson to be learned from Israel's experience, and it's found in Psalm 95. Let's turn to Psalm 95. Beginning at the end of verse 7, and then reading through verse 11. So this is Psalm 95 at the end of 7. Today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, as in the day of trial in the wilderness, when your fathers tested me. They tried me, though they saw my work. For 40 years I was grieved with that generation and said, it is a people who go astray in their hearts, and they do not know my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. So here God warns against hardening your heart. He warns against lacking faith in him, and he warns against going astray from his law. Paul issued the same warning in Hebrews 4. Let's turn to Hebrews 4. And starting in verse 1. In fact, that might be as far as we need to go. Hebrews 4, verse 1. Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. So he is supporting what the psalmist told us in Psalm 95. Paul says here, not to come short of entering God's kingdom. And Psalm 95 tells us how to do that. That there it says, don't harden your heart. Don't follow the examples of the Israelites who first approached to enter the promised land. And the instruction here is remain faithful in obedience to God. So if you look at the entire experience, both names for the fall festival are appropriate, the Feast of Ingathering and the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths. And as we understand now, both names foreshadow future events that will be fulfilled in their antitypes. Just referring back to verse 1 again of Hebrews 4, it says, therefore, a promise remains of entering his rest. So the word for rest is a Greek word that means putting to rest or a resting place. And it can refer to a Sabbath rest, and it can also refer to a future rest upon entering God's kingdom. That's an entire separate subject that's very well explained in a sermon on the UCG website by Larry Walker, and his sermon is called The Rest of the Story. So if you want to have Hebrews 4 explained in detail, you might want to refer to that. Larry Walker's sermon, The Rest of the Story. So Paul, again, warned not to come short of entering God's rest. And we've seen in this entire experience of Israel that the Feast of Ingathering and the Feast of Tabernacles or Booths are both appropriate names. Both names remind us of the rich meaning of God's holy days. They symbolize both physical and spiritual fulfillment of events in God's plan. The Feast of Tabernacles represents blessings that God intends to give mankind. And we are warned not to fall short of receiving those blessings.